You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
The Virtue of Selfishness by Ilan Jorna.
Let me introduce myself. I'm Ilan Jorna. I don't think we've met. That was a joke. So. I should have a sign when I'm giving a joke. All right. So, my talk is about the virtue of selfishness, but I want to start with something that might seem really far removed from morality or ethics. A long time ago, people thought very strange things. They used to have really weird ideas. For example, a long time ago, most people thought that the sun revolves around the earth. How many of you still believe that? Come on. Okay, nobody? Okay. A long time ago, people used to think that the moon was a perfect sphere, like a billiard board. There's no valleys, no mountains. Nobody believes that anymore, right? Just checking. And then another strange thought people used to have, and they really believed this, that all animal species and all plants were the same throughout time. They never changed. They were just the same from the moment of creation about 6,000 years ago. Now, we don't believe those things anymore, most of us, I think, because of people like these, scientists, Galileo, Newton, and Darwin, and many other people who worked after them and alongside them. What they did is they challenged dogmas. They challenged existing beliefs that were really fundamentally wrong. For example, the idea that the sun revolves around the earth. We've gotten away from that, and what we have instead is modern science. We've unlocked the secrets of nature. We understand the laws of physics, thanks to Newton and others. We understand the dynamics of biology, of life, thanks to Darwin and others. And as a result of this foundation of modern science, our lives are so much better. We have medicine, we have technology, like all the things that we take for granted exist because of the scientific revolutionaries you see on this screen. They identified new fundamental truths that have reshaped our lives. And in an important respect, Ayn Rand is a revolutionary just like these scientists. She wasn't working in physics or in biology. She was working in the science of how to think and how to live, the science of philosophy. And what she did is challenge existing dogmas about what is right and wrong, how to live. And she offered an alternative. She identified new truths about what is right and wrong and what kind of life a human being can achieve and have for themselves. And I think what's really empowering about her approach is that it's a guide for succeeding in your life, for achieving happiness here on earth. And in order to do that, in order to present her view, she had to reject the dogmas and the false views that exist in our culture about what is right and wrong and what how to think and live your life. So what Ayn Rand is doing as a revolutionary, she's discarding all kinds of wrong views. So what she thinks is that what most people believe to be morality or good and evil is as wrong. It's 100% wrong. It's as wrong as the view that the sun revolves around the earth. And we should discard it in the same way that we discarded false views in science. So she's asking us to challenge our existing views in morality in order to find something better, something more rational, something that leads to flourishing in human life. And that is the virtue of selfishness. It is in this sense that Ayn Rand is a revolutionary thinker. So what I want to explore today in our time together is what did she stand for in morality? What is the virtue of selfishness? What did she mean by that? I'm going to introduce you to some of her ideas. And the key point I want to leave you with is that she's offering something fundamentally new and different from what most people have ever heard of. And it's incredibly, incredibly empowering. It's a guide for how to live your life. It's something that human life did not come with. We didn't come with a user's manual. It would be great if we had one. That's the role of philosophy. So I think a good place to start to understand and appreciate how different and radical Ayn Rand's view of morality is by asking the question, what do most people think is right and wrong? What is good and evil? What are the common views that people have? Now, I've put up symbols of major religions and a secularized religion following Karl Marx, socialism or communism, and different forms of it. Now, these are very different religions. They have different beliefs. And I'm sure if you've grown up in one of them or another, you recognize, oh, these are not the same thing. But what I want to draw out in looking at these is to identify some common denominators among them. And I think there's a really strong one when it comes to what it means to live a life. So what is the view of morality that we inherit from the teachings of these religions or these ideologies? Well, I think central to these ideas is duty, obedience, authority, bowing to some higher power. For example, the Ten Commandments, right? They're commandments. You shall do this. You shall not do that. And why? What's the argument? God said so. He's the highest authority. You must obey. Or in Islam, it's you have to follow Allah's laws. You must go along the true path. And under socialism and other secular views of morality, it's you are responsible for serving society. You're going to sacrifice for future generations. That was what many people were told under communism. Someday in the future, we'll have paradise on earth. You have to sacrifice for that. Or the nation, or some cause beyond you. And of course, probably the most powerful symbol of what most people take to be a religious moral ideal is Jesus Christ. And I didn't grow up in a Christian house, so the first time I saw a crucifix, it was a really shocking experience because it was almost life-size, and it had beads of blood, and it was really striking. And what it really underscores is this person, Jesus Christ, really suffered, and he died, and this is why he celebrated. Why did he die? What is the ideal that he represents? He sacrificed himself for sinners in the world. So when you look at the way people, what kind of things people are taught about morality, the common thread or common pattern is sacrifice is central to what it means to be good. Sacrifice of self to tradition, to family, to the nation, to God. This is the common view. The idea that something other than you, if you're doing it for something other than you, then that's a good thing. If it's for you, that's not a good thing. And there's different answers to that. Sometimes it's God, sometimes it's society. That is what Ayn Rand rejects completely, all the way down to the foundations. She thinks it's wrong, 100% wrong, and it's destructive. It's really, really harmful. That is what my colleague Aaron Smith is going to talk about later on today, the evil of altruism or the evil of self-sacrifice. I just want to stress the point that she's rejecting this as a dogma, something that's not founded in reason, facts, and argument. And it needs to be discarded the way we discard false theories in other fields like science. So what is her view of morality? It's very different from what we've heard growing up and from all sorts of sources in our society. Rand's view of morality is not to teach you how to suffer and die and sacrifice. Morality is about how to teach you to live, enjoy your life, and flourish. It's a conception of what a good life is that it's in the tradition of the ancient Greeks who looked at life and said, what is the best kind of life you can have, and how do you achieve it? So one way to think about what her view of morality is, it's about creating values, creating the character you need to achieve things in life and to succeed and enjoy your experience of life, because you have one brief span of time here on earth. Make the most of it. And for her, the highest moral ideal, the highest moral purpose is your own happiness achieved by your own means. Now, when I talk to people about the virtue of selfishness, I get this reaction. Ah, what are you talking about? This is crazy. Selfishness and good, they don't go together. this must be a joke. I mean, selfishness in most people's understanding is the definition of what it means to be a bad person. It's the opposite of what everyone thinks of as a good thing. And the common view is, well, why do you need guidance on how to be selfish? It's obvious. You're a jerk to people. It comes easily to people, right? You're thoughtless. Or maybe you lie and cheat and steal, or you stab people in the back and you're a schemer. But the way people think about selfishness, it seems like, well, what's the big deal? It's this nasty thing, and you don't need any guidance to do it. Well, I want to challenge both of those assumptions. Number one, it's not about exploiting people. It's not about being a predator or sacrificing other people for you. It's about creating values and creating relationships that are mutually beneficial. Whereas for most people to be called selfish is an insult. If you understand Ayn Rand's reconception of what selfishness is, it's a high achievement. It takes real work and thought. Fundamentally, it takes commitment to reason to achieve your own interests in life. And I want to stress something about her view of morality. And this is one of the things that makes it really distinctive from conventional thinking about what is good and evil. And this is it, that there are no sacrifices. A sacrifice is when you give something up that is really valuable for something that's not valuable at all or not worth anything. It's a loss, a net loss. It's a surrender of the things you value, the things you treasure. And for Ayn Rand, you shouldn't sacrifice yourself to other people. Nor should you sacrifice them to you. So that means the crook, the criminal, the kind of stereotype or the conventional view of a selfish person, the criminal, the liar, the cheat, that is not at all what she's talking about. In her view, those people are not even remotely selfish. They do not have even the beginnings of an idea of what it means to have an interest, let alone serving their own self-interest. It's a self-destructive path. So there's no sacrifices, either of you to other people or of other people to you. So then what really does it mean to be selfish? What does it take? If it takes effort, well, what kind of effort, what kind of steps do you have to take to achieve your own interests? Well, here's another sharp contrast with conventional thinking. The last thing people expect to hear about selfishness is that it has a code of principles, a set of virtues. You have to really think about what it means to live in your own interest and think, what is in my interest? It's not obvious, it's not given, you don't wake up knowing. And we're the kind of beings that we need that kind of guidance. So, you know, unlike animals that can hunt, we can't hunt very well. We need tools. We need to create things. And unlike plants, I don't know if you've ever tried this, put your feet in the soil. Do they grow roots and get nutrients? No, we don't. We're not even remotely like that. We don't get the things we need to live from nature. We need to create them. We need to achieve them. And you're not born with any kind of character. You need to create your own character. You have to define the kind of things that are important and achieve them. So for Ayn Rand, being selfish means following a set of moral principles, a set of virtues. And the point of these virtues is these are principles that guide you towards your own success. They're guides to living a flourishing life. That's the end point. If you want to be happy, these are necessary conditions you need to follow to guide you in navigating life. And the key virtue, the central virtue is rationality. Again, most people think of self-interest. They think, well, it's go with your feelings. Do what you feel like in the moment. That's not at all what Ayn Rand is saying. She's saying you need to use your mind, your reason. And for her, that means it's the only way you're going to understand the truth, what's true and false. It's your only source of knowledge. It's your only source of values. And your only guide to action. So the essential guidelines of rationality is follow reason. And I mean, it's crucial to understand. Emotions are a huge part of life. They really matter. But they can't guide you towards success. They can't. I mean, they're not reliable sources of truth. They're not reliable sources of what's your interest. You need to conceive that. You need to think about that rationally. I mean, just think two quick examples of why is it you can't follow your emotions as a guide to what's in your interest. How many people here like donuts? Raise your hand. A lot of people like donuts. How much do you like donuts? Who had their hand up? How much do you like donuts? Would you eat 2 donuts? Okay. Would you eat 20 donuts in one sitting? Okay. So it might feel good to eat 2 or maybe 20 donuts. Like you feel the sugar on your tongue and it kind of starts, you start getting that buzz and this, ooh, that you can feel it. It's going through your body. That's in the moment and you think, this feels great. I want this all the time. And then 10 minutes later, you're starting to feel a little bit down here and it's not good. And then later on, it gets worse. And then, you know, and if you make a habit of it, you're not going to be very healthy, right? So there's clearly things that you feel like doing or that might feel good, but they're not at all in your interest as a human being, as a sum of all your experiences. And then if you flip it around, how many people here like to go to the dentist? Okay, there's a few people. Yeah, okay, I'm not one of them, but... What is it about going to the dentist? The dentist is there and they're scraping your teeth, they're cleaning your teeth, and it's not pleasant, right? It's not my idea of fun. I wouldn't do it as a hobby. I don't like it, but I recognize that it doesn't feel good, but it's really important for my health. If I don't have teeth, it's going to be a huge impediment. So there's clearly things that are uncomfortable or don't feel good that are really important to achieving your values in life. Or take something more serious. Like, I mean, the dentist is one thing, but so you're working on a project with someone at school or at work, and they're not doing their part of the project, and things are falling behind. And so you need to talk to them and say, what's happening? How can we get this back on track? And it's going to be an uncomfortable conversation. I don't know if you've had these, but they're all over the place. And a lot of people don't like having those conversations because they make us uncomfortable. Conflict. A lot of people are conflict averse. And the last thing they want to do is have a confrontation or an argument. I don't know if you had those kind of things in your family, but they're not pleasant. But it's really important if you want to get this project done, you want to achieve this goal in terms of its part in your interest, you need to do it. So clearly, your emotions matter, and you have to think about what your emotions are about and what you're feeling, but they can't guide you toward what a conception of your interests is. To do that, you need to use your mind, your reason. You need to think about what are the things I need in my life to achieve and accomplish, and how do I do that? To think that through takes a commitment to following the facts wherever they lead you, including and regardless of what the conclusion is going to be. I won't ask you to raise your hands because I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable, but how many times have you had this experience of, well, if this is true, that's going to be a really uncomfortable fact for me to live with. For example, if it's true that there is no God, what does that mean about how I've been raised? That can be really unsettling. But if it's true, you have to rethink your assumptions. Or what if someone in my family, what if one of my uncles really is just a bastard? Like someone's really mean. And if you accepted that truth, it would have to affect your relationship, and it wouldn't be convenient to have, you couldn't really be the same kind of relationship where everyone's pretending to like each other, because he's a mean person. You can't pretend that someone is nice when they're not. So there are all kinds of ways in which you have to really face the facts wherever they take you. That is what it means to follow reason, rationality. That's the principal virtue. And I'm just sketching sort of the big picture here. Now, being an egoist requires using your mind, using reason. But it requires, in various areas of our life, there are derivative virtues that are aspects of reason, of rationality. I'm not going to talk about all of these. There's a lot here. Someone who's selfish is also honest? Yes. Someone who's selfish has integrity to their principles? Yes. They're productive. They're not a parasite. They take their own character seriously. That's what it means to have pride in Ayn Rand's conception. And justice. This is a very unfashionable thing today, is to judge people. But what Rand means is you need to judge them objectively. You need to evaluate people Why? Because it's in your self-interest to find people who are good and who are positive influences on your life, who enrich it, people you can love, people you can live with, people who can be friends, and avoid the people who are toxic, people who are destructive or can harm you. You need to be objective. You need to judge them rationally. And finally, independence is a virtue for Ayn Rand. Now, that is a really distinctive view, a really distinctive idea that this is essential to your ability to succeed in life. So what is independence? I want to stress this one because it really stands out as something that certainly not anyone's conception of what it means to be selfish, but it's essential. It goes to the heart of what Ayn Rand is arguing for in her moral theory. So the virtue of independence is about using your mind and putting your orientation on the facts, not other people, not tradition, not authority, no one else's judgment. Your judgment is first and nothing comes above that. And that is a principle that applies in all areas of life, in all your relationships, all the time. And it's a guide for navigating difficult situations. And all situations, really. But let me give you a couple of examples of really difficult things that maybe some of you have lived through. Some of you know people who've had this. Or maybe this is in your future. So, a couple of examples. Number one, this is to illustrate what it means to have independence and why this is so crucial to your happiness and why, if you follow this principle, it empowers you to succeed. So suppose, how many people here are still in college? A lot of you are still in college, okay. So this is when I was in college, I was still figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. And suppose you're in college right now, as many of you are, and you think that what you want to do is be a teacher. You want to work in a classroom, and your passion is connecting with young people, teaching them things, explaining things, finding new ways of communicating to them knowledge that they need. And you've done some of this practice work. You know what's involved in being a teacher. You're passionate about it. Your full judgment is, that's how I want my days to be. I want to wake up in the morning, jump out of bed, go and teach a class. That's what you're passionate to do. But then your parents have a very different picture of what your life should be. They think, or your dad in particular, thinks you should be a doctor because it's respectable, the money's good, and it would look good in the family's reputation to have a doctor. Why not? There's some prestige associated with being a doctor. And you not only want to be a teacher, you don't want to be a doctor. You find sick people unpleasant, you don't like blood, and you don't like all the stuff that comes out of people, you know, fluids and all kinds of stuff. It just grosses you out. You hate being around hospitals, and you just don't want to be a doctor. What do? Can you imagine your life where, can you imagine a scenario where you abandon your dream of being a teacher, and instead, you go through medical school and you do what your parents do. You follow the duty. You serve their wishes. You sacrifice your desire for theirs. And then you have 30 years of being a doctor and you hate every single day of it. What would that look like? Is that a path to flourishing? And notice what it turns on. It turns on who decides this kind of issue. Are you in control of your life? Are you the one who's assuming the responsibility of making these decisions and going by your judgment? Or are you borrowing someone else's conclusions and following their decisions for you? You're letting them pull the strings and you're a puppet. The virtue of independence tells you, you need to assume the responsibility for your life. You have to take it seriously, think through what you really need to achieve to create a flourishing life, and it's your judgment that counts. You have to put that first. Your parents can have input, they can tell you what they think, but you can't relinquish control and give it to other people because it's your life. It's yours. You have to assume responsibility. Let me give you one other example, because I think what I want to stress is that this is really pivotal to whether you can find a path in life and direct yourself towards achieving happiness. So how many people here have families where, so I grew up in a Jewish household, And one of the things that really mattered to my mother was, if my brother was dating someone, one of her first questions was, not is she pretty, is she friendly, is she nice, is she Jewish? Because it was a big deal to stay within the tribe, to stay among Jewish people, to marry within the tribe. And I know a lot of Muslim families, it's the same thing. It's a really big deal if you step out of the Muslim religion, you date someone outside that, or in some Christian communities too, and I think in various cultures, it's a big deal that you don't leave the tribe for the person you want to date or marry. But suppose the person that you've chosen, that you think, this is someone I want to share my life with, or someone I really love, they bring real meaning to me, to my life, I enjoyed it. It's crucial to me, but they're an outsider. And you're getting pressure from your friends, from your cousins, from your uncles, from your aunts, from your mother and your father. How dare you step away from us? This is a betrayal. Can't you find a good Jewish girl? Can't you find a good Muslim girl? Or worse, they'll decide one for you and push them toward you and make that decision for you. Who decides that? Who's in the driver's seat? You need to decide that. It's your judgment that counts, because it's your life and it's your happiness that's at stake here. So the principle of independence is one virtue out of a whole system of a whole code of virtues. It's to put your judgment first, your perception of the facts, your understanding of what is in your interest, and that has to be the decisive factor. And there are lots of ways in which this happens. You and your judgment versus all kinds of pressures from the family, the tribe, religion, society, the nation. There's so many ways in which you're pushed towards serving some purpose other than your own. And you have to navigate that. That's just one aspect of how independence applies in our lives. And the key I want to stress and leave you with is that these virtues that I've been describing, rationality and others, and particularly independence, their purpose is to help you navigate towards your conception of what's your interest. What does it mean to serve them, your interest, and how to achieve happiness in your life? Because that, in the end, is the purpose of morality. So Rand's conception of morality is radically different from what we've grown up with and what we hear from all sorts of sources in our culture. It tells us to follow reason, rationality, not our feelings. It tells us to be productive, to achieve our own values by our own effort, and to assume the responsibility of living, of our own lives. Take your life seriously and act to achieve the goals you need. To be selfish means to really put in the effort and the thought to define your goals and really work to achieve it. And it's possible. And that is part of what makes it so empowering. It's a guide for you to be happy. And what more could you want in life? I think that is a really profound and inspiring goal to have. Thank you. We'll take questions now, and I'll be joined by my colleague, Yaron Brook. So we have a mic right here, if you'd like to come up. I know in the last session, we ran out of time for questions. If that happens again this time, again, please don't be discouraged. Come back. There'll be more time in other sessions and also, of course, in the question period later today.
Go for it.
So if selfishness is a virtue, why did not Ayn Rand include it in the seven virtues? And if selfishness is the crucial virtue, why she said rationality is the crucial virtue, and not why she didn't she say rational selfishness is a crucial virtue?
Okay. I think the answer is the virtue of selfishness is one way to think about her whole view of ethics. It's that be selfish. That's the basic conception of what it means. And defining what is a virtue, it's what are the principles that guide you towards achieving certain goals in different areas of life. And I think the fundamental is rationality. Now, there's a deeper perspective on this, which is to be rational, to use your mind, is selfishness. I mean, in a fundamental self, yourself is your mind. So the virtue of selfishness, I mean, one way to think of it is be rational, use your mind. That's the core of what she's arguing. Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, the scope, the purpose of immorality is your own life. That's what selfishness as a virtue captures. And virtues are actions you take. So you're acting towards your own life. And then the question is, well, how do I do that? What actions do I need to take to act towards my own life? And that's the seven virtues that you have. But overriding that, the purpose of all that, the for whom, the answer to for whom am I doing this, it's for you. It's in your selfish interest. So technically, in a sense, selfishness is not, it's not at the same level as the seven virtues, right? It's overriding. It's what frames the entire ethical system. It answers the question, for whom should I act?
Do you think that the people at Boeing were being selfish and rational when they were designing the 737 MAX?
So do I think the people at Boeing were selfish and rational when they were designing the 737 MAX? No, I think they weren't. I think they were short-sighted. They were cutting corners. They were trying to meet goals that were unrealistic. Sometimes businesses make mistakes. Some of those mistakes are consequences of moral vice, that is evasion. Sometimes the mistakes are just mistakes of knowledge. They didn't know. But I think the evidence suggests that in Boeing's case, these were evasions. These were ways of cutting corners, getting things fast, pressure that was placed on them not to have the right kind of training, not to use simulators, not doing things. So no, they certainly were not selfish. And you can see the consequences, right? It's like when you ask, well, is taking drugs selfish? No, and you can see the consequences. Look what happens to people who take drugs. Well, you can see the consequences. Boeing is losing a huge amount of money. A lot of those engineers might lose their jobs if Boeing really starts to struggle. So the consequences, the consequences are horrific for them cutting corners on rationality, on being truly selfish.
Can I add to that? I think the other consequence that's not seen, but it's real and it matters, is they have to live with themselves. And they have to know that they know what they did if they cut corners and they made those conscious decisions. And they have on their conscience the consequences. And that is, you're imprisoning yourself in hell forever, basically, when you do something like that, psychologically.
Hi. I was raised in a very religious country. And when I was little, I sort of questioned that and realized that I did not believe that it was true. And at the beginning, it was very scary because it meant to me 95% of people in my country believe something that I think is false. And if this is true, what else is false, right? I mean, I have to figure everything out. It's a hole that never ends. And I think you need a certain degree of courage to even make that leap. So my question to you is, how can you make other people have the courage and the independence to make the leap in the first place towards their own reason?
Well, I think that part of how you do that is by suggesting that there is a philosophy. That is, there are answers. So you're right. It's very challenging. It's scary because you have this sense, particularly if you come from a culture that's very religious, you have a sense that, where do I even go? How do I discover anything? How do I know that I'm not going to be sucked into some other religion? So the idea that people have done this before you, that there are other people like you, and then that there are philosophers who've thought about the fundamental issues and provide certain answers and are using reason in order to guide you is very helpful. So I think Ayn Rand helps here because she has thought about what do we do with morality if there's no God? How do we live? What's the path? What's the guide? Well, philosophers have thought of this. Here's one philosopher who's really given it a lot of thought and presents her ideas on the basis of reason.
Thank you.
So we'll take two more questions, and then Aaron will be joining us on stage to begin his presentation. Yes, go ahead.
Thanks. Well, I'm just interested in your opinion. Well, what do you mean about making compromises? for example, in relationships, you know, we have to be selfish in that way, and we just make compromises like every day. For example, I do that. I do make compromises, for example, like, I don't know, I love you, and I will do that because of you, not because of myself, mm-hmm. even if I'm not okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to differentiate between the type of compromises you make, right? So it's not as long as the compromise is not a sacrifice, right? So for example, yeah, I mean, I often do what my wife wants. because I love her. Because she's such a huge value to me. Because her happiness matters so much to me. There are very, very few other people in the world that I will do what they want me to do just because of who they are. But with my wife, because she's such a value to me, you know, if we eat at this restaurant or that restaurant, doesn't matter that much to me. But if it matters to her, then it's a higher value to make her, to add to her satisfaction that evening than it is for me to get the exact food that I wanted that evening, right? So as long as the compromises do not constitute a sacrifice. Now, when Ayn Rand talks about the evil of compromise, she's talking about compromising about morality, compromising about the most fundamental, most important aspects of your life, and therefore where it is a sacrifice, where it is you're giving up something more important than what you're getting, or you're getting nothing in return, or you're getting actually an undercutting of your values in return. That kind of compromise you have to watch for and never commit. So you don't lie even for somebody you love. You don't compromise your independence even for. So even though I do what my wife tells me, I don't do it without thinking, right? I don't do it thoughtlessly. I do it independently. It's my choice to do it, right? And again, not on everything. She sometimes does what I tell her.
Sometimes, thanks.
So last question.
All right, so I have actually tried to deconstruct the theory of ethics you have given today. And at the end of the day, I believe that your argument, overall argument, is resting upon the assumption that there is such a thing as a clear cut between altruism and egoism. On the other hand, literature in moral psychology or ethical motivation has shown that it is not the case. I mean, we are more complex than that. We are complex deliberative beings. Our moral deliberation is a lot more complex than basically assuming that we are either egoistic or altruistic. And on the other hand, even the most philosophers who are the most keen on egoism, egoistical, rationalist, ethical egoists, psychological egoists, and so on, actually agree that it is only a hypothetical state of mind to show the consequences of that. And on the other hand, I believe that if we take everything from that, Ayn Rand's ethics can be summed up as individual utilitarianism.
Wouldn't you individual agree with
that? What? Utilitarianism. Wouldn't you agree on that? And if that is the case, then I believe that individual utilitarianism has a lot of problems, even amongst utilitarians. Thank you.
So, no, I don't agree with that. Okay. And I don't agree with the whole characterization. I don't think there are many people out there, including all those that you listed, egoistic psychologists and so on, who actually understand what egoism is. And I think Ayn Rand is very unique here in identifying egoism and grounding it in reason rather than, you know, most egoists out there, most people who advocate for egoism or explain egoism, talk about it more in terms of emotions than in terms of actual reason. So I think there's a huge misunderstanding out there in the world of psychology and in philosophy about what egoism actually means.
I mean, I'm a philosopher. And on the other hand, I mean, when we talk about selfishness now, I think that is a terminological...
When we talk about,
selfishness.
Selfishness, yes.
I think that is more of a terminological misunderstanding because the concept of selfishness that Ayn Rand takes, she actually redefines the concept of selfishness.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's pretty useful in the long run in the philosophical discourse.
So I don't want to argue about whether it's good to use the term selfishness or not. What we're trying to talk about today is her concept of selfishness. You might say she's redefined the term.
Right.
Fine. I mean, that's a separate discussion. But what we're discussing is I think that her view of egoism and her view of selfishness are unique. They're different than the ways in which selfishness and egoism are used by philosophers, by psychologists out there in the culture. I think their use of the term is wrong because it misidentifies the source of what it means to be an egoist. That is, they don't have enough respect for reason. They don't have enough respect for the means of human survival, which is rational thought. Now, it's the same with altruism. They don't clearly define altruism. They use altruism as this floating thing of being nice to people and behaving in kind of reciprocal relationships with people, rather than kind of the Augustine Comte sense in which altruism stands for, or the Jesus Christ sense in which altruism stands for, which is living for the sake of others and being selfless in the process. That is the emphasis, and Aaron is going to be talking about that in a minute. So it is, if you view egoism, if you take from what we said today, to be an egoist, to be selfish means not caring about other people, then of course that doesn't make any sense. Rand's conception of egoism takes into account other people, in that other people are enormously valuable to self. She doesn't reject that or deny that. She embraces that.
I actually really hope that we can talk a lot more about this later on, because I can agree to disagree now.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you for your answer.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.